Last week, my wife and I, we had our first son. So, if you don't mind, this message is for them. Babe, son, daddy is coming home a champion!
Welcome to episode 272 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com here for Cinco de Mayo, Sunday, May 5th, 2013. I am the Sala Monster. Hope everybody's having a great weekend and out celebrating and drinking and carousing and doing what people do on Cinco de Mayo. Now, last week, I announced on the show here that we had an official app, the Sound Off did, in the Google Play Store. For those of you with Android devices, you can go in there for free, download the official Sala Monster Sounds Off Android app. You can leave a review, rate the show. Thank you to everybody who did that this past week. But have another fun little announcement this week, and that is that the Sound Off is now officially available through Stitcher, Radio On Demand. I had a lot of people ask me about this over the past few months. When is the Sound Off going to be on Stitcher? And I didn't know too much about it, looked into it. I know a lot of you guys download multiple podcasts, not just wrestling, but all sorts of stuff. And I guess you like having it in one place, in one app. Now you can have the Sound Off as part of your podcast assembly, I guess, in the Stitcher Radio app. Type in Sala Monster Sounds Off. It comes right up. You can stream the most recent show, all the past shows, going back at least the past several weeks. Leave some feedback in there. Facebook comments, I guess, all that good stuff helps us out. So Stitcher Radio On Demand, we are now officially available through the app and the online platform. The best way, the easiest way still to get this show, of course, is through SEScoops.com. Go to the website, download directly. But for those of you who want it through Stitcher, you wanted it, you got it. Check us out on there. This was a great frickin' week to be a fan of professional wrestling. You had no less than six good to really good matches, excellent matches even, on WWE television alone this week. This is not even taking into account any other wrestling that you may be into. And we'll get into the Impact report a little bit later on. Impact this week, not really a great show, but I'm talking more WWE in this case. If you couldn't find one match that you really liked on TV this week, then I don't know why you bother watching wrestling in the first place. Just stop and find a new hobby would be my advice for you. This was probably the best week of in-ring action in WWE all year. And it was coming off an exhausting European tour. You know, these guys go overseas for these European tours a few times a year. And you look at the travel schedule, and it's just, you know, bang, bang, bang. One night they're in the UK, the next night they're in, you know, Ireland, and the next night they're in Wales, and just all over the map. And they come back, and they come right back to Raw and SmackDown. It's like, as I said in my Layfield Report column this week, no rest for the weary. And that really was the subject of the column I did for LayfieldReport.com this week. It was about a great week of WWE action, something positive for a change to focus on. All the great matches, and some of the younger guys, the newer names that were prominently featured in some way, shape, or form. You know, you got guys like Cody Rhodes and Antonio Cesaro, who have not exactly been featured as prominently as they should, or have been on a losing streak, or have been a laughingstock, or have been just relegated to the mid-card for one reason or another. And not necessarily that their status has changed much because of these matches this week, but they went out there this week, and I think they opened a lot of eyes. It started with Raw Monday night. You had Randy Orton and Cody Rhodes, which a pretty nondescript match. We've seen these guys in the ring before. Obviously, they have their history with Legacy. They went out there, and they gave these guys a good 15 or 16 minutes. And as I said in my Layfield column, you know, there's a lot to complain about when it comes to these three-hour Raw shows. And I still do, because 3 hours is just way too long for a wrestling show. Especially, you know, WWE has so many hours of television now. They just keep adding shows. They're not taking away shows. They're adding new ones each month, it seems like. And so a three-hour Raw is just way too long. But when they announced the three-hour Raw format last year, one of the potential benefits that I think a lot of people, myself included, talked about is, well, you got 3 hours of television to kill. Maybe that means we won't have five-minute matches every week. You'll actually have some weeks where matches are allowed to go 12, 15, 20 minutes. And we have seen that. We saw that Monday night. We had Orton and Rhodes in there for 15 or 16 minutes. And you know damn well that if Raw was still 2 hours, there ain't no way Randy Orton and Cody Rhodes, unless they're in the main event, are going out there for 16 minutes. It's just not happening. So they had a nice long match. Cody got a lot of offense in on Orton. Orton gave him a lot in this match. Of course, Orton won in the end, but that's fine. Cody Rhodes really showed, I think, a lot of people this week who needed convincing. I was not one of them, but the people who did, that he can go in there and he can hang with the top guy. I know Orton is not exactly a top guy like he used to be, But Orton has been to the top. He's like a 10-time world champion, and Cody Rhodes was fine in there with him. They had a very competitive, long back-and-forth match with an exciting finish. You know, what more can you really ask for? You know, then you had Dolph Ziggler and Kofi Kingston. We've seen this match a million times. It would be nice to see Ziggler in there with some fresh faces. But, you know what? As I said in my Layfield column, I can't think of two guys on the roster other than John Cena and CM Punk who probably have the best chemistry right now of any two guys on the entire roster. They just go in there and they have great matches every time they're in there. The other two would be Ziggler and Kingston. They've had so many matches at this point, they probably have the whole freaking thing memorized. And they go in there, they're very, you know, athletic, they can jump really high, they can bump really well, and it made for a very good match. And this wasn't even the best match I've seen the two of them have. But they went in there and they had a very good match. John Cena, Kane, Daniel Bryan in the main event against The Shield. It was supposed to be Ryback and Cena in a tag match against The Shield, and they, you know, worked Cena's injury into the storyline. Cena did apparently bruise his Achilles tendon, did not rupture it or tear it, which would have been a disaster for WWE. So he's still wrestling on it, but he's wrestling in tag matches at a lot of the house shows now, and Cena was out there Monday night wrestling and, you know, running around when he did his entrance. I don't know how wise that was, but Cena and Hell No against The Shield in a match that probably turned out to be a lot better than the originally planned tag team match would have been. This was a very, very good match. I have yet to see a bad Shield match. And they went in there. Shield got another big win in that match. Not that every segment on Raw was a home run, because it wasn't. We'll get to that in a second. But you can't go wrong with three really good matches like that. And you had, of course, the match a lot of people were talking about, which is Antonio Cesaro and Kofi Kingston from Main Event, a show that I don't really check out probably as much as I should. But I saw this match, and it was a great wrestling match. It was fantastic. Again, they gave these guys a lot of time. Antonio Cesaro is a freak. There was a spot in this match where he did a vertical suplex on Kofi. Kofi was outside on the apron. Cesaro was inside, standing on the second rope, and he suplexed Kofi from the apron outside into the ring with ease. Didn't need the ropes for extra support or anything. Just really, really cool stuff. Kingston wins in the end. Trouble in Paradise, kick to the back of the head. So I guess that means the road to the U.S. Championship has stalled for now for Antonio Cesaro, which is fine because Cesaro doesn't need the U.S. title. The U.S. title, I think, if anything, brought him bad luck. Hopefully they have bigger plans for him. And perhaps those plans involve, you know, a Money in the Bank briefcase. I've heard that talked about maybe. The reason that Cesaro's been losing so much. I mean, we've seen this so many times before. We've seen this with Dolph Ziggler. We've seen this with Daniel Bryan. When Daniel Bryan won the Money in the Bank briefcase a few years ago, he was losing every single match before he won that briefcase. Actually, now that I think about it, I think he was losing every single match after he won the briefcase. Maybe I have my facts backwards here, but the fact is Daniel Bryan was on practically a losing streak. I think it was actually after he won the briefcase, which really makes you scratch your head because this guy has a world championship shot in his back pocket, and so therefore we must beat him every single week. I don't quite get the logic behind that. Other than WWE figures, well, we can surprise people when he cashes in and wins the championship or when he wins the briefcase because they're not expecting it. I think that's completely ridiculous. I think everybody now is expecting or hoping that Cesaro will win the briefcase. One can only hope because I don't know what else you do with him unless you're going to, you know, put him in a Money in the Bank match and have him go over. I did pitch an idea in my Layfield Report column this week, and I'll let you guys go on there and read it if you want to. It's a Money in the Bank idea for the pay-per-view this summer involving The Shield. And it actually involves two members of The Shield winning both briefcases. It's an interesting little idea. It would make for an interesting plot twist, and it would plant the early seeds of discontent in The Shield. Now, I have no interest in seeing The Shield broken up right now. I'm not advocating they break up The Shield. I think The Shield can stay together for a long time. But you know how this story ends. Obviously, in the end, they're going to break up. Something will happen. And as part of this little Money in the Bank idea I pitch in the column, again, the idea is you plant the seeds of discontent early on, or the seeds of jealousy early on. By doing this angle, two members of The Shield are going to win briefcases, which means one, probably Roman Reigns in this case, isn't. And it could play into things down the road. So I talk a little bit more about the idea, the logic behind it, why it would make sense for The Shield to go after the briefcases, and what they would do with them after they win them. So I talk about that in my column at layfieldreport.com. Go check it out. There's a little bug right now, apparently, on the main page there where new blogs are not showing up on the main page, which is kind of a problem. Hopefully they'll have that fixed shortly. So go on my Twitter and my Facebook for the direct link to the column. Those of you who may be listening to this perhaps on TV Tracks, there should be a link to the column in the description of the video. So go check that out and let me know what you think. But SmackDown, you had Ryback and Daniel Bryan had a match. You also had Dean Ambrose in there against Kane, which was a very good match. And what I liked about both of those matches on SmackDown is that they were matches we've never seen before. I don't recall there being a Ryback-Daniel Bryan singles match before SmackDown on Friday. And they went in there, and largely because of Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan was like a machine in that match on SmackDown. He looked motivated in there against Ryback. And maybe it had to do with the fact that both guys are friends. They travel on the road together. Daniel Bryan's funny. He always does these interviews where he refers to Ryback as the Ryback. Apparently that's how he refers to him all the time. So they went in there and they had a kick-ass match to open up SmackDown. SmackDown opened and ended on a high note this week. They ended the show with Dean Ambrose and Kane, a match that we've never seen before. Ambrose had that match, of course, a few weeks ago against The Undertaker that was too short, but still very good. Undertaker beat him with the Hell's Gate, which gives Shield their first official loss in WWE. And so this week, Ambrose got a big win over Undertaker's brother. And he beat him with some weird kind of DDT-like move, and they laid out Kane after the match, and they teased that they would go after the tag team titles at Extreme Rules, so I assume we're going to get the Shield against Team Hell No for the championships, which was originally talked about for WrestleMania before they changed plans. So pick your poison. Again, so many great matches this week. If you're a fan of wrestling, then this was a good week. There's really no other way around it, and it's nice to be able to talk about that because we don't get that sort of thing every week, and I think these guys deserve a lot of credit because, again, they're coming off this European tour. I look at the schedule they're on, and it makes me very happy that I don't have the same travel schedule as a WWE wrestler. I can only imagine how they must have been feeling and the flight back and everything else. And it certainly would have been understandable if they would have gone in there this week and have phoned it in, you know, or looked a little bit sluggish, and they didn't. They went in there and they had some kick-ass matches this week, and I think they deserve a lot of credit for it. I noticed an item on PWInsider.com, actually, a little bit earlier in the week that caught my eye, and I have not really seen this mentioned anywhere else, and I thought it was worth bringing up here. The fact that the brand extension, as we currently know it, yes, in fact, there was still a brand split or a brand extension in WWE. You would never know by watching the television shows, of course. But the brand extension will officially come to an end on May 31st. So later this month, it will officially end. From that point on, the live events WWE puts on will be branded as such, WWE Live, as opposed to being Raw only or SmackDown only, which it still was up until this point. That's kind of a big story, but not as big as perhaps it should be. It's a big story in that, again, the first brand split that WWE did was back in 2002. That's when we saw the first draft, and they really were making some effort to keep the two brands separate and distinct. You had a Raw brand, you had a SmackDown brand, and those guys pretty much stayed specific to their shows. In fact, for a stretch of time in 2002-2003, arguably SmackDown was the A brand. It was the A show. Raw was, you know, Triple H's Reign of Terror, same shit every week. The real matches and the real excitement to me came on Thursday nights back then, before they went to Fridays, and SmackDown had a very distinct identity. You know, when I thought of SmackDown, there were specific guys who I thought of that you would not see on Raw. You would think of guys like Brock Lesnar and, you know, Chris Benoit, Shelton Benjamin and Charlie Haas. You know, Paul Heyman, I guess, was at the helm at that point doing a lot of writing for the show, and it showed. It showed in the on-air product. Guys had more of an opportunity, I guess, to shine and break through back then on SmackDown than they did on Raw for reasons that you could probably figure out. But SmackDown really has not had that sort of separate identity for quite some time. They take guys like Dolph Ziggler, they put them on Raw. You would never know. Dolph Ziggler is the World Heavyweight Champion. You know, I went on WWE.com a few weeks ago, and I noticed that in the Superstars section for Raw, Dolph Ziggler was listed as a Raw star as the World Heavyweight Champion. And you had the tag team champions listed under the Raw brand, of course, the WWE champion as well. I went on the SmackDown page, and the roll call of champions for SmackDown was Wade Barrett and Caitlyn. That's it. Now, I checked WWE.com before I started the show this week, and it looks like they've made some changes. Dolph Ziggler is still listed as the world champion under Raw. All the champions are basically listed under the roster pages now for both brands. But I saw that, and I said to myself, that really says it all right there. That's quite the champion's roll call for the SmackDown brand. Wade Barrett and Caitlyn. No offense to Wade Barrett, but wow. You know, back in the day, they had brand-specific pay-per-views. You had Raw shows, you had SmackDown shows. And the reason they stopped doing that was the SmackDown shows weren't drawing. The Raw shows really weren't the issue. But SmackDown was lacking in star power, so much so that people just, they weren't going to spend $40 to see a SmackDown-only show when the real stars were on Raw. Why would you do that? So they had to start mixing them up. They became Raw and SmackDown, and we started seeing the same thing on TV, where SmackDown guys were being put on Raw, the idea being they'll get more exposure, and therefore people will then tune into SmackDown. I don't know how successful that formula has been. SmackDown, I think, does pretty well on Sci-Fi. But this was long overdue, because let's be honest, the brand split has been dead for some time. When you have, quote, SmackDown guys appearing on Raw every week, there is no brand split. The brand split really lied in the house shows, and that's what's officially coming to an end here. So 2002 was the first draft. That was the first of the brand extension. It's now 2013. 11 years later, it officially comes to an end with a whimper and not a bang. WWE is not exactly promoting this as any sort of big change. And they did that poll a few months ago asking people, what would you like to see these new events branded as? And I guess that's what won out. WWE Live is what they're going to call it from now on, and that's what it should be. You know, you sell tickets based on the WWE name, not really so much who's coming to town. It's not like it was back in the day. You'd put, you know, a Hulk Hogan or a Steve Austin or somewhere, Bruno Sammartino, someone's name up on the marquee outside the building, and that would mean something. It doesn't work that way anymore. People buy a ticket because, hey, WWE's coming to my city. I think I'll go to the show, or I won't. You know, whatever they choose to do. At least they're finally ending this notion of a brand split. It's been comical for some time that people still thought this was going on. And people still were hoping that WWE might get their act together and actually really split the brands and give them their own distinct identity. And I know at the beginning the idea was you would build some sort of supercard, as though Raw and SmackDown were their two own very distinct companies, which was a joke. That was never going to happen. But if they're not going to take it seriously, then I say just end the whole thing. And SmackDown, even today, is lacking in star power. I mean, the World Heavyweight Champion is Dolph Ziggler. Apparently, he's not even a SmackDown guy. So that leaves you with Sheamus, Big Show, Randy Orton. What, maybe Mark Henry? Although, is Mark Henry a Raw guy? I don't even know. What big stars do you really have on SmackDown? That's going to be a problem for Dolph Ziggler once he's done with this whole Del Rio swagger thing, and I cannot wait until he gets beyond these guys. Hopefully at Extreme Rules, that's the end of it. I have a feeling we have not seen the last of this Del Rio-Ziggler feud. I think it's going to stretch beyond Extreme Rules, at least one more pay-per-view. But my God, I do not need to see Dolph Ziggler in the ring with those guys anymore. Just like I don't need to see Dolph Ziggler in the ring with Kofi Kingston, even though they had a really good match this week. Who does Dolph Ziggler move on to once he gets past Del Rio and gets past Swagger? I mean, what is there for him? Who does he feud with? Who does he defend the title against? Daniel Bryan? Can we finally end Team Hell No, perhaps, and give Daniel Bryan a singles push? I'd love to see Daniel Bryan and Dolph Ziggler go at it. I don't know if that's what they have in mind for Ziggler's next feud. But think about it. I mean, who do you slot in there as the number one contender for the World Heavyweight Championship? They've got a real problem on their hands. I don't know who that person is. Another bit of news that broke this week online, although this has not yet officially been announced by WWE, and it may not be until next year, but it looks as though Paul Bearer will, in fact, be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame next year, part of WrestleMania 30 weekend in New Orleans, which makes a lot of sense to me, because as I said before, when people were still wondering if perhaps he might go in this year, which would have been great, but he was very fond of Mardi Gras, was Paul Bearer, and a big fan of the city of New Orleans. I remember on his blog back when he first started it, this I mean, God, this probably goes back almost a decade. There was one photo that is forever etched in my brain that I cannot forget. And thankfully, I can't find it either. So I tried looking if it was online. I couldn't find it. But he once posted a photo of himself dressed in drag at a Mardi Gras celebration that scarred me for life. He took it very seriously, and so it would be apropos for him to be inducted into the Hall of Fame in a city that he loved, New Orleans. So I think that makes a lot of sense. The belief is that perhaps The Undertaker would induct him, although that's not confirmed. There's also talk maybe of Michael P.S. Hayes, the former Doc Hendricks, inducting him because the two of them were friends before either of them even got into the professional wrestling business. Personally, as a fan, I think the only way to go is to do a dual induction with Undertaker and Kane, both together, inducting Paul Bearer into the Hall of Fame. And then you can have his sons, of course, accept the award on his behalf. I don't like the idea of Michael Hayes doing the induction just because, even though they were very good friends, I would love to see Michael Hayes go into the Hall of Fame himself as part of the Fabulous Freebirds in New Orleans next year. I think they deserve their own separate Hall of Fame induction and shouldn't have to wait another 5 years to get it. So I'd rather Hayes go into the Hall of Fame himself next year and just have Undertaker and Kane do the induction for Paul Bearer. You can certainly have The Undertaker do it by himself, and he and Paul Bearer go back a lot longer than Paul Bearer and Kane did, but to me, it makes more sense for both of them to do it. But as long as he goes in, that's fine. I think that's really cool, and again, it's an appropriate place for him to go in, and we're already talking about the Hall of Fame in 2014, so it's going to actually be 10 years next year since they brought back the Hall of Fame inductions. It's been a decade. Can't believe that, because they went through this long stretch between 1996 and 2004 where they didn't even bother with the Hall of Fame. I guess it wasn't cool to look back on the past. That was during the Attitude Era, the Monday Night Wars. WWF was always ragging on the old guys over on TNT, and the Hall of Fame stuff kind of fell on the back burner, but in 2004 they brought it back, and next year is going to be 10 years. I wonder if they'll want to do something special for that, you know, to celebrate and signify that. Probably not, I would guess. It's not like the Hall of Fame first opened in 2004. And there's, of course, one name, one glaring omission still in the Hall of Fame left that I could think of now that Bruno's in, who should be in. I don't even have to say it, but I don't expect that that's going to change anytime soon. Let's talk about Monday Night Raw this past Monday night from Columbus, Ohio, back on U.S. soil from the European tour I mentioned earlier. The guys were supposedly exhausted. I can believe it. You can just follow them on Twitter and you can tell it was brutal travel for these guys. But they came right back, and I enjoyed Raw a lot this week, largely because of the in-ring action. I really thought this was a very good show. Raw kicked off in a bit of an odd way, but I liked it. It was Big E Langston, Zeb Coulter, and Ricardo Rodriguez in a triple threat match. So the not the three men that are involved in the triple threat match at Extreme Rules, but their seconds, I guess you would say. Their managers. Their friends. And the show had a cold open this week. It opened with Langston and Coulter already in the ring, and then Del Rio came out with Ricardo. I actually liked this just because it was different. It was a different way for the show to open. And I enjoyed the match for what it was. I thought the spot with Ricardo throwing the bucket, I guess it was, at Langston's head, it bounced off his head, he no-sold it. I thought that was very funny. And in the end, Ricardo wins. He gets a roll-up on Zeb Coulter. And so, therefore, Alberto Del Rio, later in the show, would get to choose the stipulation for the Triple Threat Championship match at the pay-per-view. So, again, I enjoyed the opening. We had a Make-A-Wish bonanza on this show. I guess it was World Wish Day, which I didn't even know existed, but apparently it was World Wish Day on Monday. And they aired footage from a Today Show segment. I know it was posted online. I didn't see it for the first time until Raw Monday night. The segment from the Today Show where John Cena surprised this Wish kid on the show. I guess this kid was born with half a heart. And John Cena, his one wish was to meet John Cena. And Cena made a surprise appearance. And I got to tell you know, watching that segment and looking at the reaction, it wasn't so much that, you know, what John Cena was doing. It was looking at the reaction on the kid's face and how genuinely surprised he was. It made me tear up. It really did. That was a really cool moment. And the fans in the arena gave it a standing ovation. Then they brought out the three Wish kids to meet John Cena on stage. John Cena came out basically to introduce these three Wish kids. Their only wish was, I guess, to not only meet him, but to be on Monday Night Raw, to be a member of the WWE roster, and so they granted their wish. For one night, they were made honorary WWE superstars. And the great thing about this segment was how well-behaved the fans were, because we all know what people think of John Cena. And we all know that it's fun and it's easy to boo John Cena. Every arena, everywhere he goes, he gets booed. Sometimes he gets booed more often than others, but he's always booed. And they behaved themselves in this segment in that you had three little kids out there, and for this crowd to have booed them or have booed John Cena would have been really, really bad. Let's just put it that way. That would have been awful. And they didn't do that. John Cena is probably the only way John Cena is ever going to get a 100% positive reaction. And I guess it's for that reason why a lot of people had issues with this segment. Let me just say, I didn't have any issues at all with this segment. What WWE does, it's obvious why they do it. Okay, I'm sure there's people that work in that company. They're genuine. They love doing stuff like this. It warms their heart. I know they've had a relationship with Make-A-Wish that goes back many, many years. They do stuff like this because it is good PR for the company. I mean, I'm a PR guy. This is fantastic publicity for the company whenever they're able to do stuff like this. Okay, I'm not blind to that fact. It's obvious. But I still thought that, even in spite of that, this segment was great because it was something that these kids really wanted. They were celebrating a special occasion. John Cena is probably the greatest ambassador that this organization has ever had. He's granted over 300 wishes. He spends a lot of time with these kids. They always honor him. And apparently he does a lot of stuff also that we just don't know about. It's not necessarily John Cena wanting people to know, hey, look at me, I'm Mr. Make-A-Wish over here. That's WWE electing to make that public. I don't blame John Cena for that at all. I think the stuff he does with the kids is fantastic. It's just really, really great stuff. I enjoyed this segment a lot. I had no problem with it. And I think a lot of people have their panties in a bunch because they don't like John Cena. That's number one. Number two, they felt, well, WWE is shoving this down our throats. How dare they exploit these kids? I don't know about you. These kids didn't look like they were being exploited. And if they were, they didn't seem to mind on Monday night. Nor did their parents. So you have to understand something. These kids, and their parents for that matter, they have no concept of any of this. They don't give a shit that John Cena is not turning heel. They don't give a shit that WWE loves to fillet themselves on television every week with their Did You Know facts and their charity videos. They don't know and they don't care. And even if they do know, they have a kid who's sick, whose only wish is to meet this guy, who wears spandex in the ring every week and fake fights people. And, you know, that's all they care about. And they granted their kid's wish, and that's something I'm sure that's very special to them. They don't give a shit about all this other stuff that people are complaining about. People don't like John Cena, and they don't like that WWE likes to pat itself on the back. And sometimes neither do I, because they go way overboard with it. But this segment I had no problem with. I think it's just a bunch of people with sour pusses on their face who have nothing better to complain about. I mean, really, let's be honest here. Of all the things that we could complain about, you're going to complain about this. A bunch of sick kids are out there getting to meet their idol, getting to stand in front of a crowd of 13,000 people getting a standing ovation. And you're going to piss, bitch, and moan about what a disgusting display this segment is? What kind of human being do you have to be to sit there and actually complain about something like this? I didn't find anything to complain about. I thought this was great. And Cena, you know, he asked each kid what their wrestler name would be. I guess one of them was the Eliminator. The other one called himself Nick the Stitch. And the other one called himself Lightning Logan. The first two sound like some mafioso here in Brooklyn I used to know. But honestly, those kids pick better wrestler names than Creative does. So kudos to them. Maybe they should get a contract. Actually, I do think it would have been funny. This is just a wrestling fan of me. I think it would have been funny to work an angle here where three other little kids all dressed in flak jackets came out to the Shield's music to attack them. Again, it's just the wrestling fan in me talking. But I have no problem with what we saw Monday night. It was actually very touching what they did here. Whatever their motives were, I don't care. This was a really cool moment for these kids. Even Jerry Lawler was on screen after the segment was over. Apparently he was getting all teary-eyed. I mean, look, again, people, they know what the score is here. They know what's up here. But it doesn't matter. That doesn't mean that when they do something nice like this, it can't have an effect on you. That one kid had half a heart. Apparently there's a lot of wrestling fans we found this week that have no heart. We had the Randy Orton-Cody Rhodes match I mentioned before. Again, they gave these guys a lot of time, and they went out there and had a great match. And as I said on Twitter, all you got to do is give these guys a chance. Cody Rhodes has not had a chance to really show his stuff in quite some time. Cody Rhodes got bumped off the WrestleMania card this year, which he was none too happy about. He even went into Twitter silence mode, so he wouldn't say anything he would later regret. So he went out there, and he looked like a man possessed, and he had a great match. And hopefully, again, that opens up some eyes, because he could be doing a lot more than teaming with somebody else and, you know, wearing a funny mustache. He's better than that. Brie Bella and Naomi had a match this week. I don't even remember what the finish of this match was. I think they tried twin magic and it backfired. I think the referee actually reversed the decision and Naomi won by DQ. But anyway, the match itself only went about a minute 15, which is pretty much average for a Divas match. Shield came out to cut a promo. They were interrupted, of all people, by 3MB. 3MB attacked. Shield beat them down. And then Kane and Daniel Bryan came out. They ended up beating up 3MB when Shield bailed. One thing I wanted to mention here, I've seen over the last several weeks on Twitter, for those of you who don't know, Gerald Briscoe, WWE Hall of Famer Gerald Briscoe. I remember Gerald Briscoe from the Stooges during the Attitude Era. Mr. McMahon, can I get you some coffee, Mr. McMahon? Gerald Briscoe is now on Twitter. His handle is FG Briscoe. And he posts a lot about his son, Wes, who's in the Aces and Eights. He watches Impact and all that stuff. And he watches WWE as well. And I noticed a few weeks ago that Briscoe started tweeting about The Shield. Because everybody is raving about The Shield. All three guys are going to be future world champions. They're so great. The Shield has great matches. All of that is true. And Briscoe tweeted something to the effect of, yep, two of the three guys are going to be big stars. One is not. And of course, that set people off wondering, who is he talking about? And he just kept tweeting about it. He just posted this series of cryptic tweets about how he's got really high hopes for two members of The Shield, and one thinks he's better than he actually is, and he's going to be mid-card at best. Now, I have absolutely no idea who he's referring to. This is a complete and total guess on my part. My guess is the two that he's referring to as having bright futures are probably Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns, and perhaps the one that he's referring to with some degree of angst might be Dean Ambrose. And the only reason I say that is because Ambrose carries himself like a star. And you hear rumors all the time that backstage, this guy, like Sin Cara. When Sin Cara first came into the company, you have to understand that Sin Cara was a big star down in Mexico. You would say for many years, Sin Cara was the John Cena of Mexico, only a much better worker, in that he was the top guy. He was working dates nonstop. He was making millions of dollars or pesos or whatever the hell the equivalency would be. Big star. And he comes over to WWE, and you start hearing stories about he's not very well liked. People are looking down on him already because he carries himself like a star. Well, because he was a star. How else is he supposed to carry himself? Like a rookie? It's kind of silly when you really think about it. So I look at a guy like Ambrose, and the guy carries himself like a star. Now, he really hasn't made much money anywhere else. He hasn't been a big star on the national stage, but he's had a lot of success on the indies. He's very well regarded as a worker. I don't think there's anything wrong with somebody carrying themselves with a degree of confidence. I think more people should. But again, this is just me speculating here. Maybe it's Rollins. Maybe it's Reigns. I don't know. But my guess would be he's referring to Rollins and Reigns, with Ambrose kind of being the odd man out here. But he won't say anything. He won't tell people who he's referring to. People are trying to coax it out of him. He refuses to take the bait. But he keeps posting these cryptic tweets. He posted another one during Raw Monday night. After this segment, he said, still like two out of the three Shield. Two will be huge stars and the other will be a regular. So I just think that's kind of... I don't know if maybe Briscoe was backstage at a WWE show a few months ago and Ambrose rubbed him the wrong way, or I don't know what the hell happened here. Or again, if he's even referring to Ambrose. That's just my speculation. But I thought that was kind of interesting. Dolph Ziggler and Kofi Kingston had their match, as I mentioned earlier. Very good stuff. Big E Langston actually laid out Kofi Kingston with two of his big end finishers, if I guess that's what he calls it, his awful finisher, after the match. So certainly looks like they may be going in the direction I suggested on the Sound Off last week, with Langston challenging Kingston down the road for the United States Championship, because it looks as though it will be Caitlin and AJ for the Divas title at the pay-per-view. And if AJ wins the championship, you'll have AJ and Dolph with belts. Technically, Big E actually is a champion right now. He is still the NXT champion, has been since December, but they don't acknowledge that on television. But it would make sense to have Big E win the U.S. title from Kofi, and now you've got that trio all with gold. But I guess we'll see if that's the direction they ultimately go in. Also, I tweeted about this during the show. I am begging. I love JBL. I write for his website. But I'm begging JBL, please, say Dolph Ziggler's name right. I noticed this when JBL first came back and was doing commentary. He can't say Dolph Ziggler's name properly. He calls him Zinger or Zigger instead of Ziggler. Drives me nuts. Sheamus and Mark Henry had a segment on this show. They had a tug of war on Raw Monday. Now, this was interesting in that Mark Henry did a tug of war. I think the first one he did was with Tenzai, and he beat Tenzai easily. Then Brodus Clay came out. He beat Brodus Clay. Now comes Sheamus. So he and Sheamus are having a fairly competitive tug of war. They're going back and forth. And what ends up happening is Sheamus just lets go of the rope. And so Henry falls backwards. When Henry gets up, Sheamus clocks him with a bro kick right to the face, knocks him out. Kind of a heel move on his part, right? Couldn't beat Mark Henry, so we have to let the rope go and then kick him in the face. I mean, it was a tug of war, not a wrestling match. So between that and the arm wrestling stuff on SmackDown on Friday, they had an arm wrestling challenge. And Mark Henry beat Sheamus in the arm wrestling challenge. And Sheamus was like, no, my other hand is stronger. Let's do the other hand. And when they went to do the other hand, he coaxed Henry into coming back. And they went to do the other hand, and he, like, punched him in the face. And, boys, it sure seems like Sheamus is the heel in this feud to me. Sheamus is a real dick. And that's not the first time I've said that either. Sheamus's behavior over the last few months, like, even with Big Show, there were things that he would say and things he would do that just made Sheamus look like a real dick. How could anybody like this guy? He's beyond me. But they'll have a match at the pay-per-view. That, again, is a match that was originally talked about for WrestleMania before plans got changed. And we ended up with Mark Henry falling on top of Ryback's head. And that was the end of their feud. Alberto Del Rio defeated Antonio Cesaro, naturally. It's about the fifth time, I think, in 3 months that Del Rio has beaten Cesaro. Ricardo Rodriguez was at ringside for this match. He was trying so hard to rally the crowd behind Del Rio during this match. But the reality is, Ricardo is more over with the fans than Alberto is. There's a truth bomb for you. That is a fact. And I don't know what that says about Alberto Del Rio, who is being pushed as their next big Latin star. I wonder if Ricardo Rodriguez may surpass him as the next big Latin star in WWE. He could certainly work. He may not have the physique or the wrestling ability that Alberto does. Alberto, of course, was wrestling for many years under a mask down in Mexico, but he is more over than Alberto is. I don't think there's any debate about that. Match was over, and Del Rio announced the stipulation for the triple threat match at the pay-per-view. He announced that at Extreme Rules, it would be himself, Swagger, and Ziggler in a ladder match, a triple threat ladder match for the World Heavyweight Championship, which is probably the only way they were going to get me somewhat mildly interested in that match, because I have absolutely no interest in seeing Ziggler and Swagger together again in Del Rio. I'm so over this. Adding the ladder stipulation, knowing that Ziggler will probably go all out in probably lunacy, putting his body through hell in this match, that may not be such a good thing after all, but at least that makes the match somewhat interesting. Fandango and Great Khali had a dance-off. It was every bit as bad as it sounds. Fans were into Fandango, naturally, until his theme music stopped. Surprise, surprise. This was a giant waste of time. I am placing bets right now that Summer Rae ends up becoming the most over part of this whole act within 6 months. She will be one of the next big divas. She will come out of this as a bigger star than Fandango does. John Cena and Team Hell No in the main event against The Shield. Ryback had refused to wrestle earlier in the show. He realized that John Cena was injured. He did not want to take a chance being in there tagging with an injured cripple, so he just bailed, and so this was the new match they made. You know, one of these days, I think some member of The Shield is going to end up doing a faceplant, hopping over that barricade, coming to the ring, and it may well be Seth Rollins who does that forward roll when he jumps over. This was a very enjoyable match, and you know, one other observation I had that I didn't mention earlier when I mentioned the match is that Kane was in this match, and Kane just turned 46 years old when they were actually overseas in Russia for the European tour. There were some funny photos online of Daniel Bryan wishing Kane a happy birthday at the event. He put one of those Russian hats, the furry hats, on his head, and for whatever reason, he had the Russian hat on his head, and Kane had a banana in his hand. I don't understand what the significance of that is, and nor do I want to know what Kane was supposed to do with said banana. But Kane just celebrated a birthday, 46 years old, Kane is. Now think about this, The Undertaker, who has looked good in some of his recent matches. Undertaker looked a lot better moving around than he did last year even, or the year before, in his recent matches with Punk and The Shield. But Undertaker still is broken down, does not move around as well as he used to. He's 48 years old. He's only 2 years older, I believe, than Kane. And Kane, in this match at least, didn't look a day over 36. He was moving around in there. He's still jumping off the top rope. I think that was actually the first column I ever did for LatefieldReport.com. I decided to do a column on Kane and how freakish the man is, and that it's very odd to see a man as big as he is. He's a big guy, 6'8", 6'9", close to 300 pounds, if not over 300 pounds. Moving around and jumping the way that Kane does, and seemingly his knees are okay. I've never heard of Kane having any knee issues or knee operations or having bad knees or anything like that. With a guy that big, that's normally the first thing you hear about is bad knees, because you're moving around on such a big frame. And as old as Kane is, Kane's not old, but as older as he is now, I mean, he's been wrestling for a long time. I'm kind of surprised by it. He's been very durable. His longevity makes him one of the truly special performers in WWE history. He doesn't always have great matches. For whatever reason, I feel like when Kane had the mask off, Kane had some horrific matches. And I don't, again, it's, there's no correlation between his wrestling ability and the mask. Just for whatever reason, without the mask on, he had so many awful matches. And it almost seemed like when the mask got put back on, he was more motivated. I don't know. He's had some pretty good matches. I guess it depends on maybe who he's in the ring with. But he was in there and looking good, and it's just an observation that I made. The guy is a freak. But the Shield ends up getting the win in this match. In fact, the Shield got a pinfall on the WWE champion. They pinned John Cena. An injured John Cena, but nonetheless, they pinned John Cena to win this match. So the booking of the Shield continues to be fantastic. I've never seen a trio of newcomers booked as well as these guys have before. It's quite the contrast to what they ended up doing with the original Nexus, which started very strong, and then they beat them all at SummerSlam within 2 months. Shield has been around now a lot longer than 2 months, and they have yet to be beaten as a unit. Aside from that one singles loss to The Undertaker by Ambrose a few weeks ago, they have yet to lose. This is how Nexus should have been booked in 2010, before they botched that whole thing up. So all I can say is keep it up. John Robinson of ESPN.com suggested over the past week, he put, I guess in his column or whatever on there, suggested that if John Cena's injury were to keep him out of action for any length of time, which it won't, this was before we knew the length of, or the breadth, I should say, of Cena's injury, he suggested that WWE should strip him of the championship and hold a tournament to crown a new champion. And if that sounds familiar to you, you will recall that my idea on last week's Sound Off was to hold a tournament to crown not a new champion, but to crown a number one contender that would then face Ryback at Extreme Rules for the vacant championship. So in theory, Chris Jericho would be a good candidate to win the tournament, and he could face Ryback and probably do what Daniel Bryan did on Friday night and give Ryback the best match of his career. Ryback would win the championship, finally, after months of losing, and Cena could chase him for the championship when he comes back. I still like that idea, actually. It's too bad they didn't do it. Let's transition over into Impact Wrestling from Thursday night. Sting has been named the number one contender for the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. As I predicted a while back, Sting would probably get the title shot at Slammiversary, with AJ Styles clawing his way back on his road to redemption, getting the title shot at Bound for Glory. I have seen online reports this week suggesting that, in fact, it may not be AJ Styles getting the title shot at Bound for Glory. It could be Hulk Hogan. I refuse to believe that. I call bullshit on that. I cannot fathom Hulk Hogan wrestling for the World Championship, so therefore, I just refuse to believe it, and I think it just makes more sense. They seem to be building AJ Styles as the next big thing, as far as somebody to challenge Bully Ray, so I will stick with that. I still stand by that, that it will be Sting, he will lose, and AJ Styles will. And by the way, you know, AJ Styles, if I remember correctly, by virtue of losing at the pay-per-view last year, I believe the stipulation was that he would no longer be allowed to get any World Championship matches for up to 1 year until Bound for Glory 2013. Surprise, surprise. The timing could not be any more perfect. So I tend not to buy into those rumors. I think AJ will end up with that title shot and probably with the title at the pay-per-view in October. But for now, Sting is your number one contender. He defeated Matt Morgan in a match to earn the next title shot. And what a match this was. Really, I should say, what a finish this was. The match itself was okay. But the last minute and a half or so of this match, my God, how awful this was. He put Matt Morgan in a scorpion deathlock that was so absurd. It's the only way I can describe this. It looked so absurd. It made Morgan look so weak. He had to sell for it, and then they did a pass-out finish in this match. Morgan actually passed out from the pain, supposedly the pain of this scorpion deathlock that Sting... First of all, Sting is standing up. He has him in the scorpion deathlock, he's standing up. So basically, he has Morgan's feet wrapped up. So perhaps Morgan passed out because, I don't know, maybe he cut the blood circulation off in his feet and it caused him to pass out? I don't know. That would be the only logical way to possibly explain what happened here. And I get that it's wrestling. You know, The Rock, for example, puts an awful sharpshooter on people. The Rock should... He got better at it, I will say. The times I saw Rock use sharpshooter this year, it was better than it has been in years past. Maybe Bret Hart had a little chat with him about it. Because even Bret Hart has needled The Rock before about what an awful sharpshooter he used to put on. This topped The Rock... this made The Rock sharpshooter look like Bret Hart in his prime. Now, perhaps it had to do with the fact that Matt Morgan is a big dude. Matt Morgan is a legit 7 feet tall, probably in the 300-pound range, give or take. He's a big dude, and Sting is 54 years old. He's not as big and strong as he used to be, so it probably was a little laboring for him to have to hold up Matt Morgan's big tree trunk legs. I get that, but this looked terrible. There's just no excuse for it. Eventually, what happened is he kind of fell down. He had him in the scorpion. I think Morgan reached the ropes or something happened, but Sting, I think, put it back on him. Then he fell. He kind of fell, but in falling, it looked a little bit better, I guess, in that he was actually sitting down. But the fact that Morgan is a guy that TNA wants to push. He's a young guy. He's never really gotten over commensurate with the push that he's been given, but they're trying with him. And I don't know if the plan for him long-term is to make him a world champion or what the deal is. They're doing this whole storyline for months now where he's ragging on Hulk Hogan. He's telling Hogan, all you do is make mistakes, this and that. And I don't know if it's leading to a babyface turn or if it's leading to a Hogan-Morgan match. I have no idea. And by the way, boy, after this, could you imagine if this led to a Hulk Hogan-Matt Morgan match? Wow. I certainly hope that's not the direction they're going in. But my point is, if the plan here is to build Morgan up as something special, this did him no favors because this looked so phony and unrealistic. And it also made me very sad because I found myself for the first time truly looking at Sting in a match and thinking, this is an old guy. I know he's 54 years old, but I really have yet to look at Sting up until this point as an old man. Like, he's in there, he holds his own, he's still jumping around doing stinger splashes and everything and trying to hang with the younger guys. And he's been very good on promos, probably doing some of the best promo work of his entire career in TNA, as compared to his WCW days. And this was the first time I really looked at Sting. And he's been wearing the t-shirt for a while, I guess, to cover up his physique and all that. First time I've looked at him and I've said, this is an old dude. And that's sad. And it's sad that he, yet again, for the zillionth time, is getting a title shot. They've gone back to the well with Sting yet again. It really shows the lack of depth at the top of the food chain in TNA that they have to keep going back to Sting in these situations. They've got former world champions in Bobby Roode and Austin Aries, but they're both heels. I get that. So that's not going to work right now. They've got James Storm, whose amazing transformation from world champion to referee is now complete, and I'll have more on that in a bit. Jeff Hardy is out. He's had a million title shots already. Rob Van Dam is gone, and he's not the answer anyway. Kurt Angle? He's not the answer. Samoa Joe could be the answer, but they've beaten him down so much. There's no current Aces and Eights member I can think of that they can turn who would be compelling enough to challenge Bully Ray for the championship, and that includes D-Von. To be honest with you, aside from AJ Styles, the only other person that would make sense, given his past history with Bully, and the fact that they've kept him away for so long that it would almost seem fresh, would be the Monster Abyss. And I love the Joseph Park character, and I hope there's a way to keep him around in some capacity even after Abyss comes back. But Abyss would make sense. I mean, you're not going to get a great match out of him. Abyss was never a great wrestler. Joseph Park is even worse. But at least it would be someone other than Sting. Chris Sabin made his Impact Wrestling return for the first time in nearly a year. He pinned Zema Ion in a three-way match, X Division match, that included Sanjay Dutt. You could tell Sabin was playing it safe in this match, as well he should. No flying moves for him in this match. The referee headcam gimmick they got going on during these matches has got to go. They tried something new with it. It doesn't work. I wish they would just get rid of it. It's very distracting. Before the match, they aired a good promo package for Chris Sabin, which included him talking about wanting to compete for the world championship. So, to go back to what I was just talking about, perhaps even Chris Sabin could be a potential contender for the world title, a new face in the world title picture, although that's probably still a ways off. But I could see Chris Sabin potentially being the next Austin Aries in TNA, in that he's the next X Division star to really break out as a legit title contender. But again, there's a lot of questions with Sabin, if, you know, his health, his knees. Can he stay healthy? Is he going to get hurt again? And can he get over to the level that Austin Aries did? One of the big reasons that TNA almost had to push Austin Aries is because the fans were into him. They were chanting his name. They were going crazy for him. He got himself over. It remains to be seen if Chris Sabin can get himself over, but TNA is certainly giving him a lot of help. You know, with these promo packages and everything, they're really trying to make him into a big deal, which is pretty cool, and that's what they need to do. D'Lo Brown volunteered to take out Kurt Angle on this show. Bully Ray made him swear on his colors, which, last time I checked, really the only color they wear is black, and D'Lo himself happens to be black, which is probably why he lost his match and is probably going to become the first member to be excommunicated from the Aces and Eights. It could be Booker T and the NWO all over again on Impact this week. Bully Ray is going to confront D'Lo. I guess we'll find out. But indeed, D'Lo lost in an I Quit match on this show to Kurt Angle. I don't remember the last time D'Lo had an official match, which it may well have been the last time that D'Lo Brown made a comeback in WWE, which was on a random episode of Raw, I want to say about 5-6 years ago at this point. They brought him back. He actually was kind of over with the crowd, had a pretty good match. I don't know if he made one more appearance after that, but they never brought him back. That was it for him in WWE, so this may have been his first match in 5 years, because I don't remember him wrestling since then. We were informed that Suicide won the fan vote for former X Division guys that they wanted to see back for a match that is taking place on the May 23rd episode of Impact, so we are now one step closer to my Suicide vs. Curry Man idea becoming a reality. This must happen. It must. We had an entertaining back and forth between Bad Influence, Bobby Roode, and Austin Aries, who will be having a match, finally, on Impact this Thursday to determine the number one contenders to Chavo and Hernandez's tag team belts. Champions came out to interrupt, and they introduced James Storm as the special referee for the match. So basically, both teams are fucked, and the match will likely end in a no contest. My guess is that we get a three-way at Slammiversary for the tag team titles. Boy, TNA sure does love their three-ways. Bunch of freaks, those people are. At this point, we got the Kurt Angle D'Lo match I mentioned. When that match was over, Kurt Angle called out AJ Styles. He said he wants AJ to be on Team TNA next week in their big six-man match against Aces and Eights. It's going to be Sting, Kurt Angle, and a third man against Bully Ray, D-Von, and Mr. Anderson. And Kurt Angle is giving AJ Styles 1 week to figure out whose side he wants to be on. Personally, I think having one Sting on Team TNA is enough, but I guess we'll find out Thursday night what AJ decides to do and if we'll have two Stings on Team TNA. Taryn Terrell and Mickie James beat Gail Kim and Tara after Terrell rolled up Tara for the pin. I guess that's her new finishing move, the dreaded roll-up. She should stuff strawberries in her tights, and then she can call it the fruit roll-up. Anyway, after the match, Gail Kim attacked Terrell, gave her the eat defeat, locked her up in a figure-four leg lock around the post that would have made Bret Hart very proud. Then came the main event with a scorpion deathlock that would have made Bret Hart proud. He wasn't watching the show. Matt Morgan came out wearing Hulk Hogan's robe from Shea Stadium, the one he stole from Hogan's beach shop, I think, last year. I don't even remember the last time I saw him wearing that thing on TV. He looks so goddamn ridiculous in that robe. I mean, there's a reason Hulk Hogan stopped wearing it. In fact, when he stopped wearing it, his career took off into the stratosphere. There's a lesson to be learned from that. I talked about the match earlier. It was fine until the end. I can only suspend my disbelief so much. The image of this 7-foot dude having to sell for Sting, basically holding his feet in the air, was just completely preposterous. And then the fact that they did the Austin finish with him passing out from the pain, just completely ridiculous. And that was Impact. Let's move on to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. This comes to us from Matt. You brought up during your review of Impact last week why there was so much crowd noise for the Velvet Sky Mickie James match. I was at the show live, and here is the reason. Before the match started, Jeremy Borash got on the mic and said, "The loudest fans during this match will get to go backstage." He actually did this all night long and only ended up taking 4 fans backstage the entire night, but in any event, that's why the crowd was so hot. So that comes from Matt. There's your answer. Jacob writes in, "Greetings from Norway. I was hoping you could give me a shout-out as I turned 19 on April 18th. And have been listening to the show since that great TLC pay-per-view last December. My question is, who would you like to see win the Money in the Bank briefcases? My hope lies between Cody Rhodes and Antonio Cesaro, since they've been shit on these days, and Wade Barrett, we can finally have the first English WWE champion if he wins. I'd also think Barrett would be a good babyface. What do you think? Also, will there be a sound-off app for us Windows Phone users?" Windows Phone? As Gorilla Monsoon might say, highly unlikely. As for Money in the Bank, I think Cesaro would be a safe bet. Talked a little bit about that earlier. Cody Rhodes, not so much. I think it's less likely. I'm not saying it's impossible. I just don't think they quite see Cody on that level yet. I do see Cody as a future world champion at some point, just not anytime soon. But I think Cesaro is certainly a pretty good guess on your part. You know, maybe they're killing him off, like I said, because they think it'll be a bigger shock when he finally wins the briefcase, only we all figure he's going to possibly win the briefcase because he's being shit on. Hence, it's not really a surprise, which, again, I don't know why they do that. But check out my LayfieldReport.com column because I do pitch an idea for The Shield winning both briefcases this year, the logic behind it, and all that good stuff. So I think that's certainly a possibility as well. I hope and assume the Shield will still be together come this summer. Summer's not that far away, and I think it would make for an interesting idea. Tejas from Los Angeles wanted to know if he can get a shout-out for his 21st birthday on May 11th. "It's going to be a good day," he says. An optimist. I like that. Happy birthday, dude. Abdullah from the Philippines, "Do you think CM Punk's pipe bomb promo had a big impact on Triple H's decision to improve the developmental system? And do you think Punk's promo played a big role in WWE pushing Daniel Bryan, Ryback, and The Shield?" Well, I don't know where you get Ryback from, but, I mean, Ryback got a big push because he's a big dude. That's why Ryback got a push. But Daniel Bryan, absolutely. I think Punk and Bryan both broke down a lot of doors in WWE. And this is just me as a fan observing some of the guys they've pushed since Punk and Bryan became big stars and world champions. They seem to be more open to recruiting, you know, quote, indie guys. I mean, they've got Pac under contract now. He's Adrian Neville down there. They've got, of course, Cassius Ohno, the former Chris Hero, is still down there as well. Sami Callihan supposedly is all but signed to a contract in developmental. Last I heard, he had submitted his medicals, and they were just waiting for him to pass all of his tests. So they certainly seem more open to welcoming these guys from the indie scene, guys that have gotten over and become big stars on their own, and I think a lot of that has to do with the success that Punk and Bryan have had. Bryan goes out there to this day. Daniel Bryan is a glorified tag team wrestler right now. He will go out there and get a reaction like nobody else except maybe John Cena, and that's only because half the crowd wants to chant Cena sucks. He will go out there and get a reaction from the crowd that I won't see anybody else get. None of the other top stars. They're chanting yes, they're chanting no, they're going nuts for this guy. The fact that he was able to get over like that on his own, it opened up a lot of eyes. They really did, and I think it's really been to the benefit of WWE's developmental system because they got a lot of really good guys down there now in Florida, and hopefully they'll bring even more of them in once this new performance center is open. They'll have more room, they'll have 7 rings, all this training going on at once. hopefully they'll sign some more guys like that. As far as the Shield, same thing. Absolutely. I think the Shield getting the opportunity that they're getting now has a lot to do with Brian and Punk getting over. And I think the Shield is going to go down as a great case study of what happens when you take three unknowns, to the WWE audience, three unknowns, three young guys, and you push them as main eventers. That's what the Shield is. They're main eventers. They've been in a ton of pay-per-view matches at this point, one of which was a main event. Even it didn't headline the show, I guess, at TLC, although it should have. But they are out there as believable main eventers. Dean Ambrose is out there wrestling Undertaker in the main event, wrestling Kane in the main event. They're out there on Raw in a six-man against Cena and Team Hell No, and people aren't not buying into it. They buy into it just fine. So, I think they broke down doors, and they really did a lot to help these guys out. Now, Abdullah has another question, this one regarding Vampiro. Do you think WCW tried too hard to push him as their version of The Undertaker, and why was he not signed by WWE during the invasion angle? I'm not sure if Vampiro had any baggage that made WWE not want to touch him. He didn't always have a sterling reputation behind the scenes in wrestling, and to be honest with you, Vampiro never did anything for me. I can't speak for his early years in Mexico when he became a big star, but from what I've seen of him, including his work in WCW, I don't see what the big deal is with Vampiro. I just don't see the appeal. I think WCW tried to push him harder than maybe he should have been pushed, although I give them credit for trying to push a new guy. You know, the Sting-Vampiro feud, at least it was something different. I don't know that Vampiro was ever going to get over as a big star there. I mean, other people might argue they didn't push him enough. Maybe I just haven't seen that Best of Vampiro DVD. Maybe I'm missing something here. But from what I know of him, You know, WWE needed plenty of other people during that invasion other than Vampiro, that's for sure. I've talked about that a million times before. Ric Flair and Scott Steiner and a bunch of other guys off the top of my head, way more than Vampiro is what they needed to make that invasion angle work. Flint Gome writes in, just want to say thank you. I listened to one of your old episodes where you talked about The Shield, the TV series, not the stable. And I gotta say, after watching the first episode, I was hooked. See, I told you, anybody who watches that first episode, you will be hooked on that show. You have to start from episode one. That's what gets you hooked. And what happens in that very first episode of the show leads to a chain of events that unfold in the ensuing seasons. It colors all of the other episodes for the next, you know, six or seven seasons that followed. It is my all-time favorite TV series. I love that show. I'm very sad it's not on the air anymore. Anyway, Flint does have a question. What happened to the TNA Drinking Championship? I saw it one time back in 2007. James Storm or Bobby Roode had it. Well, seeing as how I was not exactly following TNA that closely in 2007, it's hard not to see why with ideas like the Drinking Championship. I'm sorry, the Beer Drinking Championship. I guess we have to make that distinction here. We don't want to have guys on Impact going out there drinking Jack Daniels, for example. Anyway, I had to do some research on this. Apparently, the title was born out of a feud between James Storm and Eric Young, who coincidentally are the only two men to have ever held the drinking championship. And on the March 6th, 2008 episode of Impact, Rhino destroyed the title by smashing it across the ring post, and they never bothered to make a new one. And the way his career is going these days, they may just have to resurrect the Beer Drinking Championship because it may be the only title James Storm can actually win. Adrian from Melbourne, Australia writes in, do you have any idea if Rocky Johnson has heat with WWE or his son, given that we never saw Johnson in the audience accompanying his wife and the rest of Rock's family in his appearance over the last 3 years? I honestly don't know. That's a really good question. I don't recall Rock being on bad terms with his father. He did induct him into the Hall of Fame a few years ago. Maybe Rock's parents simply don't get along and he's closer with his mom and so she shows up at all the events and he keeps his distance. I'm not sure. Maybe ask Rock on Twitter. Michael from Flushing, New York. I have been listening since episode 260. You can call me one of your more recent fans. John Cena has been the face of the company now for the better part of 8 years, starting with his win over JBL at WrestleMania 21. As far as guys that came up around the same time Cena did, give or take a year or two, I could only think of Batista and Randy Orton as ones who have held victories over Cena in big match situations. All three of these guys are wrestlers that WWE made themselves. Do you think the company purposely does this nowadays? And if so, why? Should WWE favor someone they can easily make or mold over someone who was seasoned elsewhere? Well, WWE likes to push guys that they make themselves. I mean, look at Zack Ryder, for example. Zack Ryder was a WWE guy, but he got himself over, and apparently it was much to his detriment. So even if you are a WWE guy and you get yourself over, it comes back to bite you on the ass. That's just how things are, unfortunately. They could be very fickle that way, but I don't necessarily buy into that idea. I mean, if you look back over time in WWE history, they have pushed guys that they did not make. And the biggest example I could think of is probably Ric Flair. When Ric Flair came over in 1991, really, if you look back on the history of the way they treated guys like Harley Race and Dusty Rhodes, who got over in spite of the crappy gimmick, pun intended, that they gave him when he came in, it's amazing to see how they push Ric Flair as, you know, the self-professed real world's champion. He came in with the big gold belt. They put him right in a feud with Piper. They were putting him over guys. He won the 1992 Royal Rumble, still my all-time favorite title match, became WWE champion, held the company's title, and went to WrestleMania to defend against Randy Savage. It's not like they buried Ric Flair. It's not like they made fun of him. They put him in some crappy gimmick. There was a certain respect, I guess, that Vince McMahon must have had for Flair, and they treated him like gold. And guys like Goldberg, you can argue that Goldberg's push was not what it perhaps should have been in WWE, and he certainly had his issues with the company. But still, they brought Goldberg in as a big star. They brought Goldberg in. He beat The Rock. Rock wanted Goldberg in. He agreed to put him over. He beat The Rock in his first match. He did end up winning the World Heavyweight Championship. Maybe it was a month too late, but he still was champion. It's hard to say they didn't push Goldberg. Booker T came in. He ended up winning world titles, intercontinental titles, tag team titles. Now he's in the Hall of Fame. Even Scott Steiner. When Steiner first came in, he got a big push right out of the gate. Had the matches with Triple H, and in particular that Royal Rumble match in 2003, which was absolutely atrocious. Just stunk out the joint. He was throwing Triple H around, picking him up for suplexes. He was falling down. I mean, Steiner was just awful, awful in those matches with Triple H. And so, but the fact is, they still gave him a push. They didn't bring him in just to bury him. He kind of buried himself. So there are examples. WWE is willing to put their stock in guys that they don't create. They've done it a few times at least before. But, you know, generally speaking, they perhaps are more trustworthy of guys that have, been broken into their own system. Young guys that they have shaped and molded a certain way. You know, when they say that you're a, quote, WWE superstar, there's a lot that goes into that. You know, they want you to represent the company, to act and behave in a certain way. They want you to wrestle a certain style. I don't always agree with that. I think having different styles is great. I think it would be fantastic to not have everybody look the same and wrestle the same way. And it looks like maybe they're starting to get away from that with some of these guys they're recruiting for developmental. I'm slightly encouraged by that as a fan. But, you know, generally speaking, that's how they like to operate. Can I see them pushing somebody that was seasoned elsewhere? If, let's say, AJ Styles became a free agent tomorrow and WWE snatched him up, I don't look at AJ Styles as being that guy, like a John Cena guy. But would they push him? I think they'd push him, and I think he could be a world heavyweight champion. I don't know that AJ Styles would ever be a WWE champion. I don't know that Samoa Joe would ever be a WWE champion. But if they thought they could make money off the guy, then of course they would. The guy was over and was getting reactions like Daniel Bryan does every week. People were, you know, tuning into his segments and buying tickets to see his matches. They would push him. They're not stupid. Last letter here comes from Seth from Springville, Utah. He doesn't have a question so much as he has a very interesting observation. He says, as Extreme Rules approaches on May 19th, I can't help but recognize that on that date, there have been several historic things that have occurred in WWE history, several historic events. Of course, you may recall the whole May 19th storyline with Kane back in 06 when his movie See No Evil came out. May 19th, don't say that date. It was actually kind of ingenious as far as a marketing device to get people to remember that date. But as Seth observes, go back to Judgment Day, 2002, May 19th, saw The Undertaker beat Hulk Hogan for his second, WWE Championship. He said that same night, Kurt Angle lost a hair-versus-hair match to Edge And to this day, for the most part, Kurt Angle has remained bald. 2003, on May 19th, we saw the famous Ric Flair Triple H World Title match from Greenville, South Carolina, on Raw. It was May 19th back in 1946 that Andre Rene Rusevov was born. Of course, Andre the Giant, the late great eighth wonder of the world. 1996, the infamous curtain call incident at Madison Square Garden took place on May 19th. So Seth thinks perhaps we may be in for something historic on May 19th this year at Extreme Rules. I guess we'll see. We got the Triple H Brock Lesnar steel cage match. I guess they could have a historically great match, perhaps. Or it could go in the other direction and they could have a historically awful match. But I guess we're just going to have to tune into the pay-per-view and find out if you're willing to part with your $45 or $50. I don't even know what they charge anymore for these non-WrestleMania pay-per-views. The prices keep going up, and they've got standard def, and you got high def, and I don't even know anymore. But anyway, thank you for that observation, Seth. Very interesting stuff. You can email me your own observations, questions, all that stuff. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the place to send it to. You can also follow me on Twitter, as always, @Solomonster. That is the place to be. That is where I am commenting and tweeting the most. Would be, well, of course, I would tweet the most on Twitter. It would make sense. Welcome to all of our new listeners on Stitcher Radio. We are, in fact, available on Stitcher through the free app, which you can download. You type in Solomonster Sounds Off. We are under the sports category, so welcome to any and all new listeners we may have via Stitcher. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is the official profile page for yours truly. And this show, you must send me a friend request. You could also, besides Stitcher, subscribe to the show in iTunes. We also have we have an app in the Google Play Store. If you have an Android device, there are an infinite number of ways for you to listen, download, and stream this show. And you could always go to thesolomonster.com, my official webpage. You could also make a PayPal donation there, which is certainly I am grateful for if you do so. And sescoops.com, still the best place to get the sound off and all your other wrestling news throughout the week. There's a whole bunch of new bloggers and columnists up on sescoops.com and other audio as well. So there's a lot of good content up there. The sound off is really only scratching the surface with what you can get on that website. So get on there. Thank you all for listening. This is episode 272. We'll be back with episode 273 next weekend. That's Mother's Day weekend. So for those of you who are prone to forget, do not forget to at least call your mom or send her a card. Until then, be well, stay safe. We'll see you back here next week. Take care, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster sounds off on SEScoops.com.